Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode involves sexual assault, so I would like to emphasize listener discretion. Different cultures around the world have spun tales about vampires for thousands of years. The Mesopotamians, Hebrews, ancient Greeks, and Romans all had tales of demons and spirits who drank blood, though they did not call them vampires. The more modern notion of a vampire began in 18th century Eastern Europe, where verbal storytelling from many ethnic groups of the region began to be recorded and published. The term vampire was popularized in Western Europe after reports of mass hysteria in the 18th century, where people were staking corpses and accusing neighbors of being vampires. The 1819 book, The Vampire, by English writer John Polidori, kicked off today's vampire imagery. With Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula cementing the pop culture mythology that endures. Anne Rice's seductive novel Interview with a Vampire, released in 1976, further sensualized the concept of vampires. From the anemic twee vampires of Twilight to the sexually liberated and yet vicious vampires of True Blood, modern pop culture is still obsessed with the fictional characters. Of course, as with any sort of mythical creature, there are humans who strive to emulate vampires. And some cannot separate dream from reality and are thought to suffer from clinical vampirism, which usually involves necrophilia, cannibalism, sadism, and a fascination with blood. But there is a vampire subculture that is believed to have stemmed largely from goth culture, but in fact incorporates many elements of sadomasochism. These are men and women engaged in role-playing. And as we know, often role-playing is a healthy expression of sexuality, as long as it's between consenting adults. If we need to categorize John Brennan Crutchley, the man known as the vampire rapist, he would fit into the last category. He was a sadomasochist. He did drink blood, but he did not have willing partners. In fact, law enforcement and the FBI's profiler, Robert Ressler, are convinced he was a serial killer, but a cunning one who stayed too many steps ahead of the police until one girl got away. Welcome to episode 75, The Vampire Rapist. On November 22, 1985, a 19-year-old girl, handcuffed at the wrists and ankles, wearing only a towel, stumbled slowly, sometimes crawling, along the side of Hall Road, an unpaved road in Malabar, Florida. She watched as one pickup truck drove past her and didn't stop to help. She was dazed, and every movement hurt her, but she kept walking. She was trying to get far away from the house where she had been held captive. She watched as yet another truck passed her, this one slowly, as she cried, "Please help me." And this truck did stop and turn around. The girl panicked for a moment, wondering if the man she had escaped had already found her. But as she saw this man's kind face, she sobbed with relief when she was sure it wasn't the man who had tortured her over the last 21 hours. At first skeptical, the man asked her if those were real handcuffs. She just stared at him. Then he said, "Do you really need help?" She found her voice enough to whisper, "Yes. I was held captive all night. I got away by climbing through a bathroom window." The man was shocked and said, "Come on, let's get you out of here," and helped her into the cab of his truck. As they drove along Hall Road, the girl, wordless, pointed her cuffed hands to a red-bricked house. The man asked her if that was the house she had escaped from, and she whispered yes. He took her to his home so that they could call for police and an ambulance. He left her in the truck and ran to get his wife for help first. He couldn't know that leaving her momentarily in his driveway would make the girl flash back to when she had been kidnapped. It was 10:30 in the morning, and his startled wife gasped as she got a look at the girl. She said, "It's okay, dear. You're safe with us. You'll be all right now." The 19-year-old girl, who I will call Michelle, was a ghastly pale color. her dark hair making her face look completely drained of blood. The couple gave her a glass of orange juice, which she could barely sip, and she slowly told them what she had been through in the last several hours. The horrific tale of abduction and rape was bad enough, and then Michelle told them that the man had drained her blood and drank it. "He told me that he's a vampire," she said. "And while this man was a monster, he was not a real vampire. He was a violent sexual sadist and already a prime suspect in the murder of a woman he knew 7 years earlier." I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. John Brennan Crutchley was born on October 1, 1946, in Clarksburg, West Virginia, to parents William and Mildred. William was an English immigrant who came to America after World War I and spent the rest of his days until retirement working for a gas company. John had a sister who was 15 years older than him named Donna. She died during an operation about a year before John was born, under what author J.T. Hunter called peculiar circumstances. Allegedly, doctors were attempting to remove a glass tube from her bladder. The details of her death are still a mystery, but supposedly, John grew up believing his sister died from wounds that were self-inflicted from masturbating. John also had a brother who was 11 years older than him. He was named after their father, but always called Sonny. After John was born, he had a little sister, born 5 years later, named Carolyn. According to her, John, who preferred to be called JB, told her that his mother explicitly told him she was disappointed that he was not born a girl. She had wanted a daughter to replace Donna, and she told him the details about Donna's death. John claims his mother made him wear dresses and raised him as a girl until Carolyn was born. He often claimed this made him feel angry and humiliated as a young child. He also claimed he grew up in an unloving home. He said his parents beat him, and his mother once burnt his fingers with a curling iron. He also claimed that Mildred once beat him unconscious with a belt. John said he got a lot of attention, but no affection. Because of this, he became rebellious, withdrawn, and a loner. In a jailhouse interview, John said, quote, "I always shrank from affection because I didn't know how to deal with it. It scared me. I had no social skills and was scared of the opposite sex like crazy." John's mother, Mildred, refutes John's stories of his childhood. Mildred said, quote, "The stories were fantasies John made up to get attention." Maybe that's true, but serial killers, particularly sexual sadists, often have extremely strange or difficult relationships with their mothers. Ed Gein's mother also made him wear dresses and was a religious fanatic who saw women as temptations. Gein became besotted with his own mother, and after her death, he dug up corpses in hopes of making a woman's suit and other macabre souvenirs before murdering two women. Edmund Kemper said he was abused and humiliated daily by his mother, who denied him affection because she thought it would, quote, turn him gay. As a teenager, Kemper shot and killed his grandparents and was sent to a mental institution for 6 years before being released. When he got out, he murdered 8 women before he bludgeoned and beheaded his mother, raping her corpse and using her head for a dartboard. These are just 2 examples. Google serial killers and mothers and you'll actually find top 10 lists because the phenomena is so prevalent. The point is, Mildred Crutchley denied the abuse, but John told several friends, reporters, and even his sister the same stories. At 10 years old, John and his family moved to Upper St. Clair Township, Pennsylvania, after his father was transferred there. While living there, John began delivering newspapers. He also began learning how to fix electronics, often helping his neighbors fix their televisions. As elementary school ended, John's grades were bad. His parents sent him to a psychiatrist in Pittsburgh to figure out what was going on, but the psychiatrist said John was just spoiled. John's grades were bad in high school as well. He really only cared about physics and math, and despite his other bad grades, John was often referred to as a math genius. He got straight A's in those subjects, but any other subject he didn't care about and didn't bother with studying. He had to attend 1 year of remedial classes at an Episcopal boys' school in Virginia before he graduated from Upper St. Clair High School in Pittsburgh in June of 1965. The only college John was accepted at was Defiance College in Defiance, Ohio. And while there, he started working at radio and television stations, making his way up to chief engineer. Campus police suspected John of a series of thefts, but they could never prove any of them. It would be another behavior pattern that went on into his adult years. He worked part-time at Zeller Corporation, further honing his skills at assembling computers and other electronic devices. But after 5 semesters, John was put on academic suspension, and in 1967, John transferred from Defiance to Point Park College in Pittsburgh so he could try to work on his grades. While there, he met a girl named Maud Alma Motes. She was an attractive petite brunette, and she encouraged John in his studies. After 1 academic year at Point Park, he was able to transfer back to Defiance College. In 1968, he began working at a radio station as an engineer as he finished school. In 1969, when he was 22 years old, he married Maud. Though he would later say he did not love her, and in fact never really loved anyone. But Maud was passive and didn't mind his sexual needs, which were becoming more and more dark. They moved into a trailer at a mobile home park in Defiance after they got married. In 1970, he was fired from the radio station because of claims that he had electronically bugged the station with sound surveillance equipment in the attic so he could eavesdrop on other employees. Although he hadn't graduated from Defiance College yet, John was hired to work as a project engineer at General Motors from March 1971 to March 1973. John finally graduated from Defiance College in Ohio on August 13, 1971. After leaving General Motors in March of 73, John moved to Kokomo, Indiana for a new job. Maud stayed in Defiance and filed for divorce. They were divorced by July of 1973. Maud later said that John's stealing caused arguments between them. He had started shoplifting after they were married, not for things they needed, but just for the thrill of it. The arguments would turn violent, and John would beat her, strangle her, and suffocate her. She said he was, quote, crazy and capable of anything. Most telling, he often strangled her during sex, and she even blacked out once. Maud also said he stole from his employers, and from his job history, it looks like he did move around a bit. From March 1973 to May 1977, John worked for Delco Electronics in Kokomo, Indiana. At Delco, John was accused of stealing $4,000 worth of light-emitting diodes, which are semiconductor devices. That would be around $17,000 today. While living in Kokomo, John dated a girl named Lisa, who later explained that they had an open relationship, including partner swapping. She also said she encouraged him to explore his bisexual desires. Years later, in talking about the women he had relationships with, he seemed to feel that he was closer to Lisa than any other woman, even referring to her as a member of his family. After John was fired from Delco, he and Lisa moved to Fairfax, Virginia in May of 1977, where he worked as a high-tech engineer for a company called Logicon. While living there, he enrolled in George Washington University to begin his master's degree. In August of 1977, just 4 months after he was hired, it was discovered that John had lied on his application about his salary at Delco. This was the technical HR reason he was fired, but internal notes later showed he was considered immature by his supervisors and clashed with coworkers because of his poor social skills. Lisa broke up with him when he lost the job at Logicon and left Fairfax to pursue her own career. John later said he was devastated. He began dating again, though he later said his self-image was weak, and he ran around with a lot of people like himself. He said that he, quote, picked women who were submissive, had low self-esteem, and a death wish. Around this time, John started keeping note cards on each woman and man he knew. He recorded details about everything from their astrological signs to their sexual performance. When he stopped taking these notes in 1980, he had 72 note cards. From October 1977 to December 1979, John worked for a communications company in Rockville, Maryland. During this time, he started experimenting even more with drugs and sex. He frequented sex clubs in the D.C. area. This is when he really got into bondage and sadomasochism. From September 1978 to May 1979, John had a woman living with him. He would often take pictures of this woman in bondage. She said that John liked to strangle her during sex, and also that he collected items from women he slept with. The two weren't really in a romantic relationship, but were more like roommates with benefits. He was also in a relationship with a married woman from D.C. who was a masochist. She also allowed John to take photographs of her, often black and white pictures, to better highlight the bruises he left. John claims that during this time he dated a nurse who introduced him to vampirism, showing him how to draw blood intravenously. She was careful to instruct on how much he could take before it was life-threatening. She supposedly showed him that vampirism was spiritual. Drinking the blood and the rites of ritualistic sex would purge him of his sins. John became obsessed with his new secret religion, with his fantasies dominating his daily life. Regardless, in 1978, John's roommate introduced him to a woman named Karen Luley. By November 1980, they were married in Maryland. In December 1981, their son Jason was born. John would later characterize his marriage as another one of convenience. Karen was compliant, which was crucial for him in any relationship. He had to be sexually dominant. So while he may not have loved his wife, he had affection for her because she was a sexual outlet. He used her like he did all women. In May 1981, John received his master's degree in engineering administration from George Washington University. Whatever issues he had with his former schooling had evidently been resolved. He was considered an extremely smart man and an expert in his field. From December 1979 to May 1983, he worked for TRW as a manager of the electronic systems in McLean, Virginia. In June, he moved his small family to Florida for a new job. From June 1983 to until he was arrested for the kidnapping and rape of Michelle in November of 1985, John worked as a highly paid computer expert for Harris Corp in Palm Bay, Florida. John, Karen, and Jason lived on a 2.5-acre lot of land. There were two separate living quarters, a swimming pool with a slide, and a swing set on the lot. John enjoyed his new prosperity a lot. He was into traveling, motorcycles, photography, skiing, and scuba diving. Like many other monsters before him, John's neighbors suspected nothing. They described him as a quiet, decent, and respectable man, though reclusive. One neighbor even said he was warm and easy to talk to. Despite his sexual obsessions, John Crutchley seemingly had no trouble fitting into normal society. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from our sponsors. Fall is the best season. Cool, crisp air, carving pumpkins, ghost stories, and great fashion. I love fall clothes, and especially how the fall style trends change every year, just like the leaves. But it's expensive to try out all the new trends. That's why I love Haverdash. Haverdash is the newest online wear and return clothing rental subscription. Haverdash knows there are clothes that you own, the staples of your wardrobe that are a good investment. So you can fill your virtual Haverdash closet with everything you've wanted to wear, but may have shied away from buying for yourself. Those are the types of pieces you would want to rent. And with Haverdash, you get to rock those styles once, send them back as often as you want per month for a flat monthly fee of $59. You get 3 items shipped at the same time. Whether it's work clothes or party clothes, you'll find something fun to try with Haverdash. You can keep and wear it multiple times if you like, or wear it once and ship your items back to try new stuff. And if you find something you love and want to keep, you can buy it at a discounted price. All of this for just $59 a month, making Haverdash Haverdash the most affordable clothing rental service. Head over to Haverdash.com and sign up today. There are no commitments, and you can cancel at any time. Once again, that's Haverdash.com. The temperature in most public places is only comfortable for about 80% of the population. Think about it. In your office, you probably freeze or you swelter. And not feeling thermally comfortable contributes to increased stress levels and loss of productivity. Ember Wave is the first non-medical device that helps you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. It's proven to reduce stress and improve sleep by activating the interoceptive regions of the mind that control social and emotional pleasure. Ember Wave works like a mini heater or air conditioner. It uses a thermoelectric module to cool you down or warm you up. You wear the Ember Wave like a watch with the face on the inside of your wrist. Remember getting overheated as a kid and your mom would run your wrist under cool water at the sink? That's how Ember Wave works. You just press activate when you need a burst of heating or cooling wherever you are. Ember pairs with your mind and body to make you feel more comfortable in minutes. Use Ember when you're trying to fall asleep. It helps you maintain a comfortable temperature as you drift off. Use it in an overly air-conditioned office or on an airplane like I did. I always freeze when I travel, and I felt a huge difference with the Ember Wave on my wrist. Ember is offering Southern Fried listeners $30 off. To get this limited time offer, go to emberwave.com/SFTC, and the discount will automatically be applied at checkout. That's $30 off your order today. Go to emberwave.com/SFTC. Getting in shape isn't just about losing weight. It's about learning healthier habits, practicing self-care, and finding ways to achieve your personal goals. What if you could use just one program for all your health and weight loss needs? Let me tell you about Noom. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. I tried Noom not just for dieting, but to help me learn better habits to control my blood pressure. With guidance from Noom, I can go out to dinner with friends without worry because I now have the tools to make better choices. With the Noom app on your phone, you've got support in the palm of your hand whenever you need it. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. And you're human. If you go off track, there's no shaming, just helpful tips to get you back on track tomorrow. Small steps make big progress. So sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What are you waiting for? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/Southern Fried. It's the last weight loss program you'll need. After Michelle was taken to the hospital on November 22, 1985, doctors found that she had lost 40% of her blood volume. She would have been dead within 12 hours if she had not been found. The police were able to come in and talk to her. She gave them the exact location of John's house, where she had been held captive for almost a day. Michelle told law enforcement that she had been visiting from California. She came to meet a long-distance boyfriend, but was put off when he wanted to get physical right away. Michelle had dreams of love, and she was a virgin. He shunned her when she refused sex, and she went to stay with a friend she had met in Palm Bay. At around 1 p.m. on November 22nd, she decided to go for a walk to say goodbye to the few friends she had met while she was there, because she was flying back out to California the next morning. Wearing jeans and a Harley-Davidson t-shirt, she started walking, but she noticed storm clouds building, so she turned and headed east on Malabar Road to the Intracoastal Highway. She planned to stop and get a pack of cigarettes when a small, light-colored car pulled up. It was now raining, and the man offered her a ride. He was clean-cut, slim, wearing a coat and tie, and looked to be in his late 20s or early 30s. He looked harmless to her, and wanting to get out of the rain, she accepted. He asked her where she was going, and she said she wanted to go to Melbourne to see some friends. He claimed he was headed in the same direction to his office, but needed to stop by his house to pick up a notebook for work. After pulling onto Hall Road, he pulled into a gravel drive, hidden by hedges. And Michelle saw a huge house with a beautifully kept lawn and two motorcycles parked out front. She wasn't really worried. This didn't look like some scary cabin in the woods. But when the man asked her in for a drink, she declined, saying her friends were waiting for her. He said, "Suit yourself," and walked into the house. He came out a few minutes later laughing, saying the notebook must already be in the car, and walked around to her side. He opened her door and got into the back seat, supposedly looking around for his notebook. Michelle said suddenly, her seat shot forward, slamming her head onto the dashboard. Before she had time to recover, John Crutchley had put a rope around her neck and yanked her out of the car, dragging her into the house. She said she fought hard until he pulled the rope so tight she blacked out. When she woke up, she was tied to a countertop in the middle of a kitchen. Her hands were tied tightly over her head, and her legs were stretched out spread eagle and tied at the corners. John Crutchley went slowly, drawing out the fear and tension for Michelle, asking her as he went along, as if she had a choice, if he could take her pants off. Once he did, he violently raped her. She vaguely noticed a video camera set up and pointed at her. He tightened the rope as he was raping her, and she blacked out again. When she woke up again, he was putting masking tape over her eyes. He didn't press the tape too firmly, but she could still only make out shapes underneath the tape. But she felt his hand and his cold fingers on the inside of her arm. And then she suddenly felt a sharp prick, like getting a shot. She thought he might be drugging her, but he dug the needle in sharply again, and this time she could feel the sensation of blood being drawn. She then heard a sucking sound and asked him what he was doing. He said, "I'm drinking your blood." And when she looked under the masking tape, she could see he was smiling with blood-stained teeth. He said, "I'm a vampire." And she passed out again. When she awoke, he repeated this process. He raped her, and this time he tightly wrapped a cord around her arm to make her vein pop out and attached a rubber hose to the needle. He was draining her blood into a glass beaker. He then drank it in front of her, stopping before it was empty, complaining that he hadn't drank it fast enough. And the blood was coagulating. "Next time, I'll drink faster," he said. He eventually untied her from the countertop, but handcuffed her wrists and put shackles on her ankles. He led her into a bathroom and put her in the tub. He warned her that she had better be quiet or his brother would hear her and kill her. He left then, saying he would be right back, and put his fingers to his lips, saying shh, as he closed the door. He came back for her after a couple of hours and put her in his bed, still handcuffed. He raped her again before falling asleep. At 4 a.m., she woke from a broken sleep and saw the clock, and as she did, he woke, turned her around, and raped her again. During all of this, Michelle repeatedly begged him to let her go. She promised she wouldn't tell. He kept saying, "No, you aren't trained yet." When it was daylight, he brought her into the bathroom, putting her in the tub again, and again warning her about his murderous brother. He left, and this time she thought she heard a car door shut. She thought this would be her only chance. She pulled herself out of the tub, but the door was locked, so she tried the window. She was able to unlock it from the inside, and though there was an outside lock, it was broken. She couldn't get the window all the way up, though, just a few inches. Michelle managed to squeeze herself through the window opening, falling to the ground. But if the outside lock hadn't been broken, she probably wouldn't have escaped. Weak and dizzy, she pulled herself up and began walking down Malabar Road. This is when the man in the truck finally picked her up and took her to safety. Lead investigator Robert Leatherow interviewed Michelle and was immediately convinced that this might be the work of a serial killer. There were several unsolved murders in the area where the women had been strangled. Leatherow had earned a 4-year degree in criminal justice and had taken a 3-month training course at Quantico at the FBI Academy. He took a course on serial killers from the famed criminal behavioral science agent, Robert Ressler. If you are a fan of the show Mindhunter, this is Bill Tench's character. His partner was the real John Douglas. In Ressler's class, Leatherow had learned to spot the signs of a sexual sadist and serial killer, and he knew in his gut that this is what he was dealing with. After hearing Michelle's story investigators obtained a search warrant for John Crutchley's house. Police wasted no time. At 2:37 a.m. on November 23rd, 39-year-old John Brennan Crutchley was arrested. He was charged with one count of sexual battery with deadly force, two counts of kidnapping, one count of aggravated battery, four counts of sexual battery, and one count of possession of more than 20 grams of marijuana. John told the police that the victim, Michelle, was a second-generation Charles Manson follower and that she had consented to everything. At some points in his interview with police, he would even cry. But when they'd talk to him about bloodletting, he'd get really excited and offer to show them the beaker he put blood into. Police found out that John's wife and son were currently in Maryland visiting her family for the Thanksgiving holiday. After his arrest, John's wife Karen insisted John was innocent, claiming the police were persecuting him. John was fired from Harris Corp on December 20th, 1985. On the same day, police searched John's work desk. They found a wallet with a woman named Patty Valensky's ID and pictures of her son. They also found John's first wife's ID and the ID of a former roommate. On December 2nd, 1985, John had managed to post his $50,000 bond and was released from jail. But on January 9th, 1986, John's bond was raised to $500,000. After a judge found that his, quote, ties to the community had been eroded, probably due to the loss of his job, and he was sent back to jail. Investigators had pushed for a higher bond because they were convinced Crutchley was a killer. But the judge had followed the standard bond at the time. When John lost his job, without having family in the area aside from his wife, he could now be deemed a flight risk. The police and the FBI did at least four excavations of John's backyard. His yard and adjoining properties were searched with dogs and the ground was dug up. Divers checked a pond behind his home. Several Malabar cemeteries were excavated and a crematorium was searched. Police aircraft took infrared photography of Malabar and searched for buried bodies. At one point, investigators even took core samples to see if there was any evidence buried. Inside the Crutchley house, police found chains, dog collars, dozens of women's necklaces, hair clippings, drug paraphernalia, several women's identification cards, including Michelle's, and the tubing, needles, and jar used to drink her blood. During their search, police found dozens of sexually graphic photos of a bound and gagged woman, including some with Crutchley's hand on the woman's throat. The woman was identified as the roommate I spoke of earlier. She was hesitant to call herself John's ex-girlfriend, but she confirmed that John choked her during sex and collected items belonging to women he had slept with. John's ex-wife and other previous sex partners also said that John choked them during sex. During one search, Brevard County Police found a business card for a Fairfax, Virginia police officer. Brevard called the Fairfax department and learned that Fairfax police had spent the last 7 years trying to prove that John had killed a 25-year-old woman named Deborah Fitzjohn. The two police departments began working together. Deborah Fitzjohn grew up in Fairfax County. At the time of her death, she was living in Centerville, Virginia. She had recently bought a condo near her grandparents. Deborah was working at Texaco Oil Company in the credit department, and she was taking night classes at George Washington University, which explains how John knew Deborah. They were both students at George Washington University. They met at lunch on January 19, 1978. John was living in Rockville, Maryland, and was working in the Office of Information and Communication Applications. After they started talking, they realized they had a lot of stuff in common. They were both recently divorced. They both liked the occult. John was really into vampirism, Satanism, and astrology, while Deborah was more into astrology and tarot cards. It wasn't long before John and Deborah were going on dates. After they'd gone on a few dates, Deborah told her grandmother Milda that John was a nutball and she abruptly stopped seeing him. On January 27th, 1978, just 8 days after meeting John, Deborah had dinner with her grandmother, Milda. At around 6:30 p.m., Deborah left her grandmother's house and went to her nearby condo. According to John, he called Deborah between 6:45 p.m. and 7 and asked if she wanted to come over to his house. Deborah at first said she was tired, but John said he didn't want to be alone. Probably feeling guilty, she told him to hold on. She had just gotten out of the shower, and she'd be over by 7:30. As Deborah made the 10-minute drive to John's, she passed by her grandmother's house and waved. That was the last time Milda saw her granddaughter. According to John, Deborah had been to his residence 3 or 4 times. When she got there on the night of January 27th, he was watching television in bed. As Deborah took off her coat, John drifted off to sleep. He claims he woke up as she put her coat on and left. Police believe John was the last person to see Deborah alive, and he never denied she was at his house that evening. In fact, he even gave a very detailed description of what she had been wearing, trying to appear helpful to the police. On January 28th, John suddenly went to North Carolina to visit a woman he had lived with for a while. Meanwhile, Milda was worried about her granddaughter. She hadn't come home on the 28th. So Milda went to Deborah's condo to see if she was there, but the condo was empty, and there were no signs of a struggle, and nothing seemed to be missing. After going to the police and being told it was too soon to file a missing persons report, Milda was determined to find Deborah. She found her 1976 Subaru station wagon on the afternoon of the 28th. It was parked in front of a country music dance club. Nothing seemed out of place with the car. Milda asked the people inside if they'd seen Deborah. No one had, and they had no idea how the car had gotten there. Milda again went to the police to report Deborah missing. But Deborah was an adult, and there were no obvious signs of foul play, so the police refused to get involved. So Deborah's grandparents hired a private investigator. The private investigator found that a letter from John had arrived at Deborah's condo. It was postmarked on February 4th, 8 days after Deborah was last seen. The letter was an apology for falling asleep watching television. It read, "When you get back, please call me. I don't know you very well, but in spite of your want for a new job and all, I know it's not like you to stay away for long. I like you a lot. I know that my Libra possessiveness is an affront to your Gemini want for freedom, but I really want to be your friend. At least answer my call or drop me a card. I promise not to bother you with calls at weird times like you get from that other guy. Please call. Love, John." The PI was immediately suspicious. He felt like the letter was a setup for an alibi. John met with the private investigator 4 times and eventually agreed to take a polygraph, but he didn't show up to the scheduled polygraph. At this point, the Fairfax police were finally involved in the investigation and also made an appointment for John to take a polygraph. He once again failed to show up. So the police and the PI kept looking for Deborah and investigating John. They didn't find any evidence of foul play, so it was a waiting game. But John was their main suspect and would remain their main suspect. On October 15th, 1978, Deborah's remains were found by 4 hunters in the rural Chantilly area of Fairfax County, around 9 miles from where John had lived. Deborah was found unclothed and badly decomposed. None of Deborah's clothes were found at the scene. Despite the advanced decomposition, it was determined that Deborah was strangled to death. Now that Deborah's body was found, the police pushed John hard to take a polygraph. He finally showed up, and he failed on all questions regarding Deborah's death. After this, John started purposely stalling the investigation. He filed a complaint against Fairfax investigators for being too aggressive and said they were harassing him. He was smart enough to know the polygraph could not be used against him. And as he had already been so forthcoming about the last time he saw Deborah, he probably wasn't worried about the police finding any evidence. He tried to act like an innocent man helping the police. Internal Affairs investigated the complaint but found no wrongdoing. Detectives were just doing their jobs. Although investigators were convinced John was responsible for Deborah's death, they didn't have enough evidence to charge him. But he would remain their main suspect for the next 7 years. Remember those index cards I told you John kept on the women he met? The cards were found in John's desk at Harris Corp after his arrest, and Deborah's name was found on a card. It listed her hobbies, noted that she didn't smoke, and that she was a Gemini. The last note on her card said, "Disappeared January 27, 1978. After finding this card, Fairfax police asked the state attorney to bring the evidence before a grand jury. The grand jury was set to meet on September 15th, but on the 13th, it was announced that there was insufficient evidence to press charges. After John's bail was raised for Michelle's kidnapping and rape, he was returned to jail. And a task force was formed between the Brevard County Sheriff's Office, the state's attorney's office, Fairfax County Police, and the FBI. Special Agent Robert Ressler even got involved. After speaking with John's previous sex partners, Ressler found that John was into unlimited sexual experimentation, including bondage, group sex, partner swapping, and bisexuality. A psychiatrist diagnosed John as a sexual sadist, someone who inflicts suffering on a non-consenting sex partner to achieve pleasure. But Robert Ressler disagreed. He said, quote, "I don't think Crutchley derived as much pleasure from the pain as he did from treating the person as an object, which has far more serious implications. He was much more complicated than a sadist." Ressler found that John's love of drinking blood was not common. He said that was usually seen in more psychotic individuals. John's eventual explanation for his sexual preferences was pornography and drug use. A lot of serials claim these same reasons. It may have added fuel to the fire, as Ressler put it, but it wasn't the cause. Like all serial rapists or killers, it all began in his childhood. Ressler appeared to believe in John's stories of abuse. The task force began looking into other possible victims. In total, they thought John might have been responsible for 26 deaths, 3 in Virginia, 10 in Maryland, 1 in D.C., 1 in Pennsylvania, and 11 in Florida. Police thought 4 victims from Brevard County could be victims of John. All were skeletal remains when found, and at least 2 were not identified. All of these bodies were found within a 6-mile radius of where John lived. 2 months after the skeletal remains were found, in February of 1985, police were searching for a 29-year-old woman named Patty Valansky. Remember, her ID was found in John's house. But it wouldn't be found until after Michelle survived his November 1985 attack, 8 months later. Patty was living in Scottsmore with her 9-year-old son and a roommate. But she had decided to move in with her mother in Mims. On March 15, 1984, at 7:30 p.m., Patty called her mother to make arrangements. She told her that she was ready and she could be picked up the next day. That was the last time they talked. After talking to her mom, Patty left her apartment and started heading to a convenience store. She was last seen hitchhiking along US 1 in Mims. After finding Patty's ID, investigators found out that John had dropped his wife and son off at the airport at 6:10 p.m. on March 15, 1984. On his way home, he would have taken State Route 528 East to the Titusville Mims area where Patty Valansky was hitchhiking. John later admitted to a reporter from Florida Today that he picked up Patty Valansky while she was hitchhiking. He claimed that she started talking about motorcycle gangs and demanding drugs and alcohol, so he made her get out of the car. He said he found her wallet the next day and kept it. Her ID, social security card, library card, voter registration card, and photos of her son were found in John's work desk, but he would not admit to killing her. On April 19, 1986, police talked to one of John's former cellmates. Patrick Dontell told police that John bragged about killing more than 24 women by strangling them during violent sexual encounters. Some of the women were hitchhikers. He told police that John said the woman whose identification was found in his desk at Harris was one of his victims and was missing, but they would never find her. He was probably talking about Patty Valansky. Dontell told police that John admitted to killing Deborah. John claimed Deborah was into kinky sex and liked to be strangled, but quote, unfortunately, she didn't make it to the end. John told Dontell that after killing Deborah Fitzjohn, he changed his killing methods. He decided to kill people he didn't know, like hitchhikers and transients. Dontell said John told him Deborah's murder was the only one he came close to being caught for. Dontell also drew a map for police to point to where John's trophies were, but police were unable to find them. And Dontell passed a polygraph test regarding these allegations, but he died in 1987 before police found anything and he could testify against John. On April 24th, 1986, as part of a plea deal, John pled guilty to one count of kidnapping and three counts of sexual battery. The other charges were dropped as part of the deal. He had originally been charged with seven counts related to sexual battery and one drug charge. At John's sentencing hearing, Robert Ressler testified that John should get a long prison sentence because he said that John had the traits of a serial killer. State sentencing guidelines would normally put someone convicted of those crimes away for 12 to 17 years. But the judge found John's crimes to be so bizarre and outrageous that the state guidelines were not adequate. The judge sentenced John to 25 years in prison for the sexual battery with a deadly weapon, 20 years probation for the kidnapping, and 15 years probation for each of the two sexual battery charges. He was sentenced on June 23, 1986. In order to sentence John for more than the recommended state guidelines, the judge had to cite a legal basis for departing from the sentencing guidelines. He cited, quote, the circumstances of the crime, physical and mental injury to the victim, excessive brutality and premeditation, and the vulnerability of the victim caused by repeated choking and bloodletting. According to the Orlando Sentinel, when Michelle, John's only survivor, was asked about his sentence, she said, I'd prefer the death penalty, but they can't give him that, so I guess 25 years is good enough. John's wife Karen told the press, quote, I can't see why the sentence exceeded the guidelines. It was a gentle rape, devoid of any overt brutality. I guess this woman had seen a lot of brutality in her marriage and was desensitized. I cannot imagine any other reason why she would make such a ridiculous statement. Karen did later divorce John and moved back to Maryland with her son Jason. While in prison, John was considered a hardworking model prisoner, according to the corrections officers. But law enforcement were frantically trying to find something to keep John behind bars. They knew that with good behavior, he'd be out of prison long before he reached his full sentence. But they never found anything. After serving only 10 years and 7 months, John was released from prison on August 8, 1996. His early release was due to good behavior and overcrowding. John was sent to Orlando's Probation and Restitution Center after he was released. He was only there a day before he was rearrested. The same day John was released from prison and sent to the probation center, he was given a drug test. The test came back positive for marijuana. Using drugs was a parole violation. So now they had him. John was arrested within hours after his release. He was put in jail until he could attend a parole violation hearing. At the hearing, John's attorney argued that because John smoked weed in prison, he didn't actually violate his parole. The prosecution wanted John to be behind bars for the rest of his life. They knew, but couldn't prove, that he was responsible for the unsolved murders. If he was in prison because of a parole violation, that was better than nothing. And prosecutors had a plan for if John was found innocent of the parole violation. They would make an issue about the prohibited jewelry John had while in Brevard County Jail, while awaiting his parole violation hearing. When the jail medical staff checked John out, they found that he had 13 silver rings, 12 of the rings were piercings on his penis and scrotum, and one was in his belly button. One large ring through the tip of his penis had a small padlock attached to it. According to John, the padlock on the tip of his penis was his way of proving to his wife that he would, quote, remain chaste while in prison. The medical staff could tell the rings had been on his body for a long time. These were not fresh piercings. But the piercings weren't decades old either. They determined the rings had been inserted sometime during the time John was in prison. After John's parole was revoked, the judge again did not follow state-recommended guidelines. On January 27, 1997, he was sentenced to life for the kidnapping charge, 15 years probation for the sexual battery with a deadly weapon charge, and 15 years probation for one of the sexual battery charges. But he only served 5 years. John Brennan Crutchley was found dead in his cell on March 30, 2002. There was a plastic bag on his head. He had died of asphyxiation. His death at first looked like suicide, but was officially ruled an accident. John had died from autoerotic asphyxiation while he was masturbating. I suppose that is a fitting end to someone who strangled women to death, but his victims were cheated out of justice. There is no telling how many women he was really responsible for murdering, or how many families he could have given closure. Had he lived longer, he may have confessed. He did like to talk to reporters. He was only 56 years old. And I would rather he had suffered in prison for the rest of his natural life. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic artist by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to Haley Gray for researching this bizarre case for me. I got several WTF messages from her while she was working on it, so I know it was a rough one. I've got a YouTube channel up and going. It's in its early stages, but I'm really proud of the work my friend Stephanie Janelle has been doing for the channel. It's youtube.com/southernfriedtruecrime. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media get lost, so email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Happy Halloween. And until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.